You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Emma Nelson.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes.
This negotiation is not the art of fantasy or the art of the ideal. It's the art of the possible, which is verifiable and clear in its capacity to be able to make Israel and the region safer.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry there. We examine the Iranian nuclear deal and ask if it is a triumph for diplomacy and sanctions or the historic mistake Israel believes it to be.
We'll also set the day's agenda with Monocle regular Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Oscar, what do you have for us?
We have the polls in Honduras and a new chapter on the Haitian endless revolution.
Thanks, Oscar. We'll also check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We'll leaf through today's Brazilian front pages. And before the end of the programme...
We drowned our dogs with heavy rocks and gave them up to water's trust.
We'll meet a man who found a rocky Scottish outcrop to be the most fertile of creative ground.
We'll also play some other music too, don't you worry. That's all to come here in the next hour on Midori House.
First though, the latest news from Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The deal between Iran and world powers over Tehran's nuclear programme has been generally welcomed. Iran has agreed to curb some of its nuclear activities in exchange for around $7 billion worth of sanctions relief. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has condemned the deal as a historic mistake, but most countries have welcomed it. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague says it's a good deal for the Middle East and the world.
It's a very important opportunity for the future, and I think it vindicates the policy of pressure through sanctions and diplomacy through negotiations in which the United States and the United Kingdom have been strong partners for so long, and we will remain strong partners over the coming months in making sure this deal is implemented in good faith and that we do everything possible to make sure it is followed up with a comprehensive final settlement.
The people of Mali have been voting in parliamentary elections, taking place amidst high security. It's the second vote since the French military intervention against Islamist militants in the north of the country earlier this year. August's presidential election passed off peacefully, but there's since been a surge in violence. Officials reported a low turnout for Sunday's vote, with some cases of unrest. Security was particularly high in the northern town of Kidal, where two French journalists were killed earlier this month. Political analyst Demba Bundi says it was important that the vote there did take place.
Malians expect the new Congress to deliver on reconciliation, fight against corruption, and fixing the northern problem. To hold elections in Kidal is sending a strong message to say we are ready to send a message to the whole world to say that we are a legitimate government, that we have some power, that we can control our territories, that we can impose security.
A right-wing extremist and former leader of a now banned far-right organization has been elected governor of the region of Banská Bystrica in Slovakia. Marian Kotleba, who now leads the ultra-nationalist Our Slovakia party, won 55% of the vote in the runoff against Vladimir Manka from the Smer Social Democrat Party. He's previously organised marches against Slovakia's Roma minority, and he wants Slovakia to withdraw from NATO, which his party brands a terrorist organisation. The now banned neo-Nazi party, which he once led, had expressed sympathy for the Nazi puppet state which ruled Slovakia during World War II. Indonesia's police have confirmed they've suspended cooperation with their Australian counterparts, raising the possibility of a surge in asylum seekers heading to Australia from Indonesian shores. It's the latest development in the diplomatic row, which followed reports that Canberra spied on top Indonesians. Relations between the two countries were already strained because of pressure from the new Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott's government to return asylum seeker boats to Indonesia, a move which Jakarta has resisted. Asylum seekers, many from South Asia and the Middle East, often try to reach Australia via Indonesia. China has lodged formal protests with the Japanese and US embassies in Beijing after the two countries condemned its decision to impose new airspace rules over disputed waters in the East China Sea. On Saturday, China published coordinates for a newly established East China Sea Air Defence Identification Zone. It covers most of that sea and includes the skies over the disputed islands called Senkaku in Japan and Jiaoyu in China. It also covers part of a region the seas disputed with South Korea. Beijing warned that it would take defensive emergency measures against aircraft that failed to identify themselves properly in the airspace, prompting both Washington and Tokyo to sharply criticise the move. An Australian family has reclaimed the world record for the most Christmas lights attached to their home. The Richards family, who live in Canberra, set a world record in 2011 with 331,038 fairy lights. That total was beaten last year by a family from New York. But the Richardses are now back on top of the tree with a dazzling tally of 502,165 lights. David Richards admits that setting them all up had taken quite some time.
Okay, to the Richards family for winning your record back, 502,165 lights. Congratulations, it's a new Guinness World Record.
Thank you.
And that was the confirmation of the record from Chris Sheedy of the Guinness Book of Records, and it is being sponsored by Green Energy Plan. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Yeah, I bet it is. More than 500,000 lights. Does this, Barney, though, make Canberra, therefore, a city worth going to, or is it still Australia's most boring
Well, place? I have to say, I spent a couple of days there 12 years ago, and apart from the rugby match I went for, the most interesting thing was watching the traffic lights change.
It might make him the most boring dad in Canberra come 12th night, when he has to get everything back in the box and wrap it around that horrible little cardboard inner
See,
in the box.
That's the thing he hasn't thought about, has he? It looks very good now, but you just remember on the 6th of January when you got to put it all back.
And we've all chucked our trees out.
Exactly. Maybe they're edible.
Well, yeah, we'll
of
see.
Of course electric lights are edible, Barney. Of course
Barney
they are.
Barney Burnham.
It's a thought.
It is a thought. Thank you very much indeed. It's 8.07 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
While all parties at the Geneva talks on Iran beamed at their triumph over the weekend, the warning cries ran out, most loudly from Israel. The deal reached requires Iran to limit its nuclear program in return for a partial lifting of the crippling sanctions. So is this agreement the biggest nuclear de-escalation of an era, as some have written, or an historic mistake?
One of the details to emerge from this weekend was the amount of quiet behind-the-scenes negotiations that have been held between the US and Iran. In a moment, we'll be assessing that and the durability of the agreement with Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House. But first, let's cross to Brussels to speak to Michael Mann, spokesman for the EU's High Representative for Foreign Affairs, Catherine Ashton. Michael, you must be relatively happy this morning. It's been a very long process, but a process led by your boss seems to have got a decent result.
Well, of course, it's we're very pleased. I mean, it's been several months of very, very intensive talks. Clearly, in the initial stage with the old Iranian government, they didn't go very far. But since the election in June of President Rouhani and Minister Zarif coming along, there's been a new injection of impetus into it. And my boss has been working extremely hard. We had 4 days of non-stop negotiations from Wednesday to Saturday. We finished at 4 o'clock in the morning on Sunday morning. She did an amazing job to bring together the two sides and to come to this initial agreement. And now, you know, it's a very, very good result. But of course, there's still a lot of work to be done on the comprehensive settlement that still has to be negotiated.
How much did things change? I mean, obviously, things have moved very quickly in the last couple of months. But how great was the alteration after the departure of Ahmadinejad?
It was immense. We had negotiating sessions in various places around the world, including Baghdad and Almaty, where the other side seemed to be more interested in just talking rather than actually negotiating. So there has been a new impetus since the new government arrived. I mean, my boss has had a major role in keeping this thing going through the difficult times and was able to negotiate an excellent compromise when it came to serious negotiations with the new regime.
Michael, are you at all disappointed by some of the global reaction, partly the fact that lots of people seem to think this was all down to Barack Obama and his secret back channels, but also then everyone's jumping up and down in response to what Israel has been saying? Does that in particular concern you?
Well, I mean, people can say what they like. At the end of the day, Catherine Ashton was negotiating on behalf of six world powers, and that's what she did. Diplomacy has many ways of doing its job, but at the end of the day, it was her sitting down with her Iranian counterpart and thrashing out a deal on behalf of the six that got the deal done. Of course, all the six partners have helped us immensely in this process, and it is on their behalf that the deal has been done. In terms of the reaction, most people have been very pleased with this deal. Clearly, we've seen the reactions from Israel and others, but we would just like to, I guess we need to reassure people that, we have negotiated in good faith. We have what we believe to be a solid first stage agreement, and we are aware that the work still has to be done on the comprehensive deal, but we believe that what we've got so far is a major achievement.
Michael, stay there, would you? Let's bring in Jane Kinnaman from Chatham House. Jane, lots of people are heralding this as a great breakthrough in terms of negotiations, diplomacy, sanctions. This is only the first of a two-part process, isn't it?
Absolutely. This the White House statement on the agreement is very much flagging that these are temporary and reversible measures for both sides. The hope is that this would create an atmosphere of confidence where longer term issues can be resolved.
And Jane, are you surprised actually at how little the Iranians have accepted in return for some of the stops they've done? I mean, when you look at it, the headline figure is $7 billion worth of sanctions that have been lifted or will be lifted. But they're for things like paying student fees for Iranian students abroad. They're for things like money to help them fix their planes. This seems like quite small beer for them.
It's a huge economy of about 70 million people. So this 7 billion, although it seems like a large figure on its own, is not that huge. If you do a kind of back of the envelope calculation, sanctions has probably lost them about $70 billion in oil revenues foregone. So this is about a tenth of that. It appears that it's more going to be something that will allow Rouhani to claim some victory than something that will really take the economic pressure off the regime.
Michael, let's bring you back in again. Jane was just talking about the opportunity for Rouhani to claim some victory, but to what degree was there a sense that Iran had to give up some of its sovereign pride in order for this deal to be reached?
Well, at the end of the day, every negotiation has to be something that both sides can live with. Now, clearly, that is the situation that we've got now, but I think it's also very, very important to remember that, Iran is a negotiation about the Iranian nuclear program. It is Iran that is in breach of its international obligations. There are UN Security Council resolutions against Iran. There are IAEA resolutions against Iran. So, of course, the movement has to come from Iran because that's what we're talking about. It's that program that people suspect may have been aimed at not purely peaceful means. And so, therefore, they are the ones who have to move. And, of course, In a negotiation, both sides have to be flexible and there has to be give and take. But at the end of the day, this is about curbing the Iranian nuclear program, not about anything else.
And Jane, when we look at the coming 6 months, the lifetime of this deal, what do you think are going to be the key issues on both sides when they next sit down? And what do you think both sides might be willing to give up?
Well, here it depends really whether we're talking about the six and Iran and whether we're talking about the US and Iran. So I think the US ultimately has got a broader agenda. Both the US and its allies in the region are worried not just about the nuclear programme, but about the role that Iran plays throughout the region, its sponsorship of Hezbollah in particular, its role in Syria and so forth. Those issues don't have the same unified support from the six, and the six will want to focus much more on nuclear and international law.
And just bringing in Israel, because they did cry very strongly as soon as this deal was reached. They offered a very, very sobering tone to the positivity of yesterday's announcements. Nonetheless, they now appear to be quite isolated diplomatically, don't they?
This is interesting. Israel is speaking out more than anyone else, but in voicing these concerns, they are actually reflecting the concerns of other US allies in the region, especially Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and some other countries where they don't want to be seen siding with Israel against another Muslim power quite so openly, but they are very worried about Iranian policies throughout the region, not just on nuclear.
And Michael, just finally, if we can go back to you, it was a slightly surreal atmosphere, wasn't it, at the Intercontinental Hotel in Geneva? Because you'd booked all your rooms for a certain amount of time, but then I understand it got double booked over the weekend, and there was a folk band playing Ring of Fire as you were trying to finalise the deal.
Well, there was some nice music going on in the background, yeah, but that helped to calm everyone's nerves down. We were all having a nice time.
I'm not sure how Ring of Fire claims calms negotiations, but we'll give you that. Michael Mann, Catherine Ashton, spokesman, thank you very much indeed. And our thanks too to Jane Kinmont, head of the Middle East programme at the think tank Chatham House. Don't forget to tune in at 1200 London time, that's midday of course, for the briefing where we'll discuss the implications of the Iran deal even further.
Still to come today though on this show, a check-in with our man in Denmark and poetry from one of the most isolated islands of Scotland.
And bleak poetry too, by all accounts.
It is very bleak. First though, we'll be discussing the big stories from Latin America with our agenda setter Oscar Guardiola Rivera right after this break.
Around the world, some countries look beyond military might to exert a more nuanced influence. In our fourth annual Soft Power Survey, we take the pulse of these subtle superpowers and ask if soft can thrive in hard times. Monocle Films spins the globe with a graphic animation featuring the 10 countries that we rank highest this year.
Germany's rise to the top should not come as a surprise. The country is traditionally excellent at pursuing its ideas, values and aims using diplomatic, cultural and economic tools. Germany is, understandably, wary about projecting a dominant image abroad, but by quietly doing the simple things well, it's a country that has become a global power and the rest of us can feel comfortable with that.
The Soft Parade. 10 countries getting it right. In the films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One, where the time here in London is 8:17 a.m. Time now to set the day's agenda with three of the stories we'll be keeping our eyes on throughout the day here on Monocle 24. Joining us, Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck College here in London and Monocle 24 regular. Good to see you, Oscar. Let's start with the latest from Honduras, where the presidential vote, both sides are claiming a victory.
Both sides are claiming a victory, and it seems we will be seeing a repeat of what happened in Venezuela. Opinion polls point to a close race between conservative Juan Orlando Hernández and Xiomara Castro. Xiomara is the wife of ousted former President Manuel Zelaya. Zelaya, our listeners would remember, was removed from office in a coup d'etat back in 2009.
Now, when you look at what's going on in Honduras, obviously, there's been all sorts of problems over the past few years, most notably the coup which ousted Manuel Zelaya in 4 years ago. How important is it for the country that this election and so the aftermath of the election in particular goes off smoothly?
It will be incredibly important. What the country needs the most, indeed the entire region, is stability. There has been enough violence. In fact, Honduras is deemed to be the most dangerous country in the world. It has the highest rate of homicides. So some measure of stability might allow the state to at least contain what seemed to be the sources of violence, drug trafficking, gangs. But clearly, there is a problem also with political institutions, coups and so on and so forth. This contested election is very possible that if it continues this way, if we have a stalemate when the results are declared, we will have new protests and more instability.
Who is offering a more stable route forward? We have Hernandez, who is the one, as you say, who ousted Zelaya, and then we have Zelaya's wife, Castro. I mean, it all seems like a very internal infighting, one of those awful political deadlocks that just get generational and plough a country into trouble for a very long time.
It's very difficult to see a way out of this for as long as the two sides do not sit and reach some sort of agreement. For now, what we have is Hernandez, who, as you pointed out, supported the coup, just vowing for law and order, which means more of the same repression, which hasn't worked so far and will not work. And Castro, who is vowing to represent the interrupted hope that her husband offered some time ago. But again, although there was a huge turnout, 5.4 million Hondurans voted last night, what we have is inconsistencies. So far, Castro is behind Hernandez, but the margin is very, very small. So, and both sides are claiming, and the opposition is claiming, that there are inconsistencies and also irregularities.
Okay, well, we'll keep an eye on that and see what happens. The final results are expected a little later today, although whether they are the right results, we shall see. Let's move to another country in Central America that begins with H and has had lots of problems. Haiti, there's been clashes between protesters and police. Tell us more.
The Caribbean island is seeing yet another round of what some have called the endless revolution. Again, here at the source of all problems, we have a coup d'etat, foreign intervention, and the lack of any political will to allow the people of the country to decide their own destiny. So here we have, again, a new round of protests and clashes with the police as thousands rallied to demand the resignation of current president Michel Martelly, a former pop star who opposed Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the ousted president. And clearly the protesters are linked to Famille Avalas, the party which some claim has been destroyed, but which accompanied Aristide and still has a lot of popularity.
I mean, Michel Martelly, we should point out, was elected.
He was elected, indeed. He was elected as a sort of, he promised a sort of cut-off point. He didn't come from any of the parties. So what he offered was a sort of turning of the page, a new hope, the possibility of someone who was not compromised with any of the usual political positions. But so far, it seems that things have not worked out for him. Poverty is still rampant. The total disaster that was left after the earthquake and the coup is still there. And again, like in Honduras, here at the source of it all, a coup d'etat and the impossibility of the people to express their own political desires.
What is the one thing that kicked off these protests this week? Because it's always one small thing. It's the great straw on camel's back problem.
Yeah, there is always a thing. In this case, it had to do with there are allegations of corruption and widespread violence. So it is once more a similar issue. Corruption, Martelly not being able to respond to widespread poverty. So demonstrators were hurling stones at the police in Cap Haitien and in other places. Again, what seems to be behind this is the idea that people would like to express themselves.
Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you as ever for joining us here on Midori House.
Up next, we speak to our man in Copenhagen, Michael Booth.
It is 8:24 here in London, 9:24 in Copenhagen. Let's head there now, check in with our correspondent, Michael Booth. Michael, welcome to Midori House.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Emma.
Let's start with the Danish People's Party. As we heard when we were in Copenhagen with you last week, they had a not bad set of results in the local elections. They're now using this newfound power to insist on what on the surface seems like something rather strange, pork meatballs in kindergartens.
strange and unpronounceable. Well, it's long been one of the most desired elements of the Dansk Folkeparti, the Danish People Party's policies, is to eradicate kind of foreign food from public institutions, particularly kindergartens and schools. Of course, there are sensitivities over some of the classic dishes that are served in Denmark, traditional food. A lot of it is pork-based, obviously not that appealing for the Muslim population. And in certain communities, they've been banned from schools and so on. And since this election last week, in which the Danish People's Party made gains of about 5%, they've won control or influence in some communities in Denmark. And in one of them, called Hvidovre, which is just outside of Copenhagen, they have managed to get pork meatballs onto the political agenda as a main kind of leverage to get their vote on other subjects. They've managed to persuade the Social Democratic mayor to ban, or rather to promote Danish food above foreign food.
There's been a general rise in more and more right-wing parties across Europe who are trying to embrace it or trying to pull the political agenda in their direction in using quite unusual techniques. I mean, is this something that the Danish People's Party is employing, or is it trying to sort of make the far right palatable in these respects?
Well, in times, always, it's a familiar story, isn't it? In times of economic trouble, it's very easy to pander and fear-monger amongst the population. And the Dansk Folkeparti is expert at this. Pretty much since 9/11 and even before that, they've managed to press all the buttons of a certain type of Dane who fears immigration and fears the dilution of Danish, what they see as traditional Danish culture. And the Dansk Folkeparti are absolutely expert. You have to tip your hat to them. They're very, very good at it. And this whole, in Denmark, they're called frikadeller, and they're the classic Danish dinner dish. It's just pork meatballs. And, you know, there's a certain type of Dane for whom things like that are sacred, and the Dansk Folkeparti knows exactly how to get them riled up.
Michael, sticking on the same sort of subject, or in the same ballpark, another of the issues that we discussed last week when we did the show from Copenhagen was about the attack on the poet Yahya Hassan, a poet of a Muslim background who was attacked in Central Station. He's now had to cancel readings, hasn't he, because the security forces say they can't actually protect him.
Yeah, well, the reason I thought this was remarkable, and we're talking about it again today, is it's still going on. He's still on the front pages of all the newspapers, this guy. He's an 18-year-old poet of with Muslim background who's written a quite remarkable best-selling work of poetry, sold nearly 40,000 copies. He was attacked last Monday in the Central Station in Copenhagen by a radical Islamist. That went to court, but he's also being prevented from giving readings in what the Danes call ghetto areas in the second city, Odense, third city, beg your pardon, because of worries about his security. There's talk about him having to have Secret Service protection and wear bulletproof vests and all this kind of thing, and he's very frustrated. He's very adept at turning things to his advantage and writing. He has the opposite of writer's block, this guy. Anything that happens to him, he writes a poem about it the next day, and it's in the newspapers. And so he wrote a poem about how frustrated he is at not being able to talk to the people he feels he needs to get his message across to, which are people of the same background and age as him who live in these ghettos. So he's very frustrated. It looks like his talk is going to go ahead in a safer location.
Michael, let's conclude with quite a jaw-dropping portrait of the Danish royal family. I have seen it. I urge all our listeners to go and have a look at it, obviously, after they have listened to Monocle 24 in a spare quiet moment.
I can't take my eyes off it.
It's absolutely astonishing.
Yeah. If you're feeling down on a Monday morning...
Don't look at this picture.
If you need cheering up, I still return to it for maybe the 50th time and laugh out loud when I see it. It's a portrait by a Danish artist called Thomas Krug. It's a magnificent kind of Baroque horror movie trailer poster kind of thing, showing all of the Danish royal family in a kind of classical pose, but updated for the modern era. And center stage is the son of the crown prince looking remarkably like a character from an Omen sequel.
He does look like a demon child. I mean, I know you're saying you like to look at it for a laugh. It is scaring the bejesus out of me, but I can't take my eyes off it.
He's not the only demon child in the picture either, is he? They're all
look evil.
I draw the listeners' attention to the one in the bottom left of the picture who has her lips coloured blue and is rubbing her hand. She looks like a demonic doll. Michael, what on earth got this to this stage now? Why didn't someone stop them?
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, I think he's been painting it for something like 4 years. It's now on display in the Royal Palace Museum in Copenhagen. You can come along and see it for £8. Why didn't no one stop him? Well, he has form as an artist. He's painted the Queen before, and quite a reasonable portrait. He's also painted the Crown Prince. Unfortunately, that's where the sinister tendencies began, I think, with that portrait. And now he's really unleashed them with this one. My favourite headline from the internet, and it's gone wild on social media this month, is a title for it called All Hail the Satanic Overlords.
Michael Booth, Monocle's correspondent in the Danish capital. Thank you, as ever, for joining us for that. And as you say, all you need to do is look up in the internet at Danish Royal Family Portrait and scare your family for hours.
In the next half hour of the programme, I was going to say, don't worry, that's the weirdest thing in the show, but we're talking about drowning dogs later. We're going to go through today's Brazilian front pages and we'll speak to the poet who turned his work into song. That's where the drowning dogs are. We'll also go on a vinyl spree at Rough Trade in New York.
And this is a place to be adventurous, go on an exploration, whether that's discovering new music artists, whether that's discovering a new author, publication, fanzine, or whatever it is. I think this store hopefully overall symbolises that sort of thirst for adventure.
That's all coming up in the next half hour of today's programme. I'm quite looking forward to the drowning dogs. First though, here's Barney with the latest.
Thanks, Emma. The deal between Iran and world powers over Tehran's nuclear programme has been generally welcomed. Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague says it's a good deal for the Middle East and the world, but Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says it's a historic mistake. The people of Mali have been voting in parliamentary elections taking place amidst high security. It's the second vote since the French military intervention against Islamist militants in the north of the country earlier this year. Officials reported a low turnout with some cases of unrest. A right-wing extremist and former leader of a now banned far-right organisation has been elected governor of the region of Banská Bystrica in Slovakia. Marian Kotleba has previously organised marches against Slovakia's Roma minority, and he wants the country to withdraw from NATO, which his party brands a terrorist organisation. Indonesia's police have confirmed they've suspended cooperation with their Australian counterparts, raising the possibility of a surge in asylum seekers heading to Australia from Indonesian shores. It's the latest development in the diplomatic row, which followed reports that Canberra had spied on top Indonesians. China has lodged formal protests with the Japanese and US embassies in Beijing after the two countries condemned its decision to impose new airspace rules over disputed waters in the East China Sea. An Australian family has reclaimed the world record for the most Christmas lights attached to their home. The Richards family, who live in Canberra, set a world record in 2011 of 331,038 fairy lights. That total was beaten last year, but they're now back on top of the tree with a dazzling tally of 502,165 lights. Mercy me. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you. It's 16:33 in Kuala Lumpur, 8:33 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Emma Nelson. This week's edition of Culture, which you can hear tonight at 1900 hours London time, is in New York to see a bastion of the UK indie music scene setting up shop. In 1976, Jeff Travis opened Rough Trade here in West London to sell the records he'd accumulated from around the US.
Nearly four decades later, the label that became a shop that became a brand has made its way across the Atlantic. Located in the Brooklyn waterfront neighbourhood of Williamsburg, it's 15,000 square feet large and offers a selection of 25,000 items. So what does this new retail venture look like? And more importantly, will it work? Stephen Godfrey, co-owner of Rough Trade, gave Pauline Eiferman a tour as the last shelves are being hammered into place, ready for this week's grand opening.
Thank you.
has always harboured an ambition to open a store in New York. And a few years ago, the opportunity presented itself as a result of the success of the stores that we have in London. And Williamsburg at the time was, as it is now, becoming an increasingly popular destination neighbourhood for people who are, you know, really recognise and celebrate authenticity. And it's a very sort of young average age as a neighbourhood, and again that suits our customer demographic. And things like the popularity of vinyl are connected with that, you know, celebrating music as an artifact in this, what I would argue, is a post-digital age. So Williamsburg really did fit the bill. And from a sort of commercial point of view, the scale of property available in Williamsburg suited our sort of ambition to open something large.
So why did you choose New York out of all the cities you could have chosen, either in the UK or in the world?
Well, I think New York is very much like London in that it's very cosmopolitan, in that it's a real melting pot for so many cultures and nationalities. And that really suits our type of retail in that we, you know, celebrate music from around the world in all its glory, and we encourage people to discover and to sort of step out of their comfort zone. So again, people who are familiar with embracing different cultures every day, whether that's cuisine or what have you. And I think that again, New York really lends itself to that. And importantly as well, the music industry is very strong in New York, and having that infrastructure behind you when you're opening something as ambitious as this is very important. So really tapping into that music community that exists in New York is certainly helped.
And speaking of the music industry, it's quite rare to open a music store these days. Can you talk a little bit about how your company is different?
We're very faithful to music. We don't commoditize it. We represent it and celebrate it as an art form. And I think that's very important. So when you walk into our stores, you don't see price messaging. You get to see the music in all its kaleidoscopic glory. And I think that that's engages not just artists, but also customers. And we provide as much a place to hang out as it is a place to purchase. So people come to our stores to meet like-minded people and to spend time there. It's not a sort of smash and grab, walk in, walk out. People do spend time. And again, it's very conducive to that. So this store is very unique, I think, in terms of its scale and what it's looking to offer as a sort of rounded experience. So we have a dedicated room that enables record labels to express and tell a story behind a particular release or artist in a way that they've never been able to do before. So from a creative point of view, it offers a fantastic opportunity to record labels and to artists to communicate more than just what is the sound of a release. Being a hangout where people spend time, we have a fantastic food and drink offer in the store, and working with a local company to provide the service there. From a live music point of view, we're partnering with Bowery Presents, and so the live space, which is more dedicated in this store than in our London stores, we share with Bowery, and we will have a duality where our free in stores that Rough Trade has become very well known for over the years will continue. But in addition to that, we will have ticketed events that will run into the late evening, early morning, run by Bowery Presents. So the space will be busy every single day of the week. It's quite exciting.
And to talk a little bit about the design, you use shipping containers to make a lot of the rooms here. Can you talk about what it will look like?
When we came into the store, the thing that really struck me first of all was the height of the ceilings and the fact that it is a warehouse space or ex-warehouse space. I really wanted to have something that would retain that grittiness and, if you like, pay testament to the area in terms of its history and so forth. And I think having shipping containers achieves that really nicely. And it's quite an unusual space as a result of that. We've modified the containers so they have apertures for windows or what have you, and use them in a way that I guess you could liken to like Lego bricks to create the space and divide the overall space. But it provides a really exciting and unique, stimulating experience. When you walk into the store, there are lots of areas to explore and discover on, you know, ground floor and on a mezzanine level. And again, I think that's really sort of conducive and reflecting the fact that this is a place to be adventurous, go on an exploration, whether that's discovering new music artists, whether that's discovering a new author, publication, fanzine, or whatever it is. I think this store hopefully overall symbolises that sort of thirst for adventure and that sort of curiosity of mind. Any Rough Trade store, I hope it becomes part of the community and faithfully represents the artists that will be sold here and perform here and speak here. And I think that if people can feel that it's a home from home, whether they are the listener, whether they are the performer, then that's my goal, if you like, to feel that you've provided a place where music as culture can really breathe and express itself in a way sort of free from the really imposing constraints of the commoditization that's happened in recent years.
Stephen Godfrey there, co-owner of Rough Trade, talking to our Pauline Eiferman. You can hear that report and many more on this week's edition of Culture with Robert Band. That premieres at 1900 hours London time here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. In a moment, we'll meet the poet who turned his hand to song after being cast away on a remote Scottish island. That's right after this short break.
Monocle's latest collaboration with Comme des Garçons results in a light, energizing and refreshing unisex perfume, titled and inspired by Japanese cedar Sugi. It has top notes of Mediterranean cypress and pepper from Madagascar, a hint of iris from Florence, and cedar from Virginia. With a bottle designed by Monocle's own designers, Scent 3, Sugi, is the long-awaited addition to Monocle's fragrance collection. Available in all five Monocle shops, Dover Street Market in London and Tokyo, and of course, online at monocle.com/shop.
You're back with Midori House, where the time here in London is 8:42 a.m. In a moment, we find out how a very bleak environment of a rocky outcrop, I think we could describe it, of St Kilda, inspired a poet. But first, let's listen to the music that Robin Robertson himself composed while being out in the westernmost part of the Scottish Islands.
We climbed till we could climb no more. Too old now. And too few. Our time here closing over us, while all our lives broke open like a book.
That was just a little bit of Exodus, one of the poet Robin Robertson songs of St Kilda.
Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with the rocky outcrop of St Kilda, let's just sum it up this way. It takes at least 6 hours to reach the island by boat. It's the most remote part of the British Isles. So it's perhaps no surprise that it's been used as the inspiration for this new collection of songs by the poet Robin Robertson. And Robin joins us in the studio now. Welcome to Midori House.
Morning.
Now, St Kilda, as we said, it's not the easiest place to get to. It's not the most welcoming place to go to. Why, for goodness sake, did you bother?
Well, it is, as you say, the most remote part of the British Isles. It is also one of the most remarkable when you visit it. It is effectively the rim of an extinct volcano that probably erupted about 50 million years ago. So it rises straight out of the Atlantic Ocean, a bit like Mordor, you might say. And it has the steepest sea cliffs in the whole of Britain and the highest sea stacks in these islands. And it is like nothing I've ever seen before.
But people want you to live on this place.
It's thought that it's been inhabited for about 2,000 years, on and off. Certainly, in the last 300 or 400 years, we have records to show that it's been settled by the Vikings before the Gaelic-speaking Scots were moved there by the Lord of the Isles.
Now, the collection that you've done is, the parts we've played so far are, let's face it, a little bleak. You talk about drowning dogs at one stage. Does it remain that bleak, or are there moments of happiness as well?
Well, the song cycle that I wrote with Alistair Roberts shows the whole, most of the story. There are happier moments. Summer, walking through the meadows. Summer was very short, is very short in St Kilda.
Summer was the time you went. You didn't go in winter.
No, it's almost impossible to get there, even in the height of the summer, because of the Atlantic is a monstrous sea, and the winds can just pick up and change. And if they're blowing from the wrong direction, you can't make a landfall, and so you have to make another 6.5 hours return trip.
Yeah, you can't make a mistake with this. How did St Kilda come to you? I mean, how did you hear about it? And then, you know, you can't just jump on a bus and go there. It does take some effort.
Well, I've known about it for a long time. It's a kind of legendary place, partly because of its inaccessibility, but also its cultural heritage. This was a place where the islanders, never more than about 200 of them, lived off a diet largely of seabirds. They ate fulmars and gannets and puffins. They didn't live off fish because the sea is too treacherous to fish. So they had this rather remarkable diet. They used birds for everything, including the shoes that they wore were the necks of gannets.
The island was evacuated just over 80 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
Do many people ever go back?
It's run by the National Trust, and they have a ranger there, and they have work parties that you can apply to join.
Tell me the ranger has people there with him. It's not just him on his own.
No, there are a handful. It's actually a woman. There are three or four people living there permanently, and there are visitors, but as I say, it's a hard place to just decide to go to.
Indeed, apparently some land has been put aside on the island of Lewis to be dedicated as a visitor centre for St Kilda. Lewis isn't actually anywhere near St Kilda, is it? Well, it's about as close as you can get.
It is. It's about 45 miles away. And it's usually the setting off point from Lewis or Harris. In the boat.
So explain to us how the poetry then came about, because you're on this very remote, harsh place. What kind of poetry came to you?
Well, initially we made landfall, walked around Herta, the main island, and then went back to the boat, slept on the boat, and then the next day circumnavigated the whole archipelago. And so what came out of it for me was a long poem, which was simply a kind of litany of place names. My partner, Karen Altenberg, was there. She wrote a novel called Island of Wings, which was very successful. But I was aware that once I'd left and written the poem, that my work was not done. So I got in touch with the very fine Scottish folk singer Alistair Roberts and asked if he might want to do a collaboration with me.
And have you done those sorts of collaborations in the past?
Once with him, yes. And it's a very interesting way of jolting yourself out of your tried and tested ways.
And had he been to St Kilda at all?
No.
So he was just basing this on your words
and, took it on trust,
and the look on your face when you were describing it.
That's right. Well, he read a lot of the books, you know.
Well, Songs of St Kilda is out now?
Yes, Herta Songs.
Robin Robinson, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.
Just before we head to our review of the Brazilian front pages with Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who's looking very summery despite the cold weather outside, time for some music and for more poetry. Here is one of the biggest poets of Brazilian music. This is Samba Maestro Cartola with As Rosas Não Falam.
Devias vir para ver os meus olhos tristos e quem sabe sonhar os meus sonhos por fim.
Cartola there with I'll Do My Best as Hosas No Falam. Did I do that right, Mr. Fernando Augusto
Fechoca? Very good.
It means roses don't speak.
Exactly. And it's nice to hear some Brazilian poetry after the very nice Scottish poetry as well that we just heard.
It's certainly warmer.
Yes, it is indeed. As Emma said, and as you heard, that is Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who's joined us here in the studio with a dashing new haircut, Faye. And yes, as I said, summery clothes, despite the fact it is, let's face it, bloody freezing.
I'm feeling very poetic. That's why I have my flowery T-shirt today.
He is in bloom. What's on the front cover of the Folha de São Paulo?
Well, the stories are not that nice and flowery, but shall we start with Folha de São Paulo?
Yes, let's.
Again, you know, the Mensalão story keeps on going. The former president of PT, the Workers' Party in Brazil, José Genuíno, he was sentenced to prison 2 weeks ago. But because he's got like a health problem and there was, I think he had almost like a heart attack. And then he had to go to hospital. So he just left hospital and now he's under house arrest. But for me, the interesting thing is that Dilma Rousseff, her popularity is still quite high. So basically those prisons that happened over the last 2 weeks didn't affect her popularity that much. And I think that's quite surprising.
Do you think that actually part of it is people feeling quite pleased that she's at least been prepared to see her former allies go to jail and actually stand trial in the first place?
Absolutely. And I think the other reason is that I think Brazilians think all politicians are the same. So it's not a problem of the Workers' Party, but it could happen with the center-right, PSDB, and basically any other party. So there's no politician who is above this whole problem of corruption. Maybe there's a few cases like Marina Silva, for example.
Well, exactly. Do we think... I mean, look, I'm sure he probably is ill, but... Are there a few sort of raised eyebrows that he's just decided, oh, you know, just like Mubarak, just like lots of others. Who was it in Britain?
It was the Guinness scandal.
Ernie Sanders.
Ernie Sanders, who's bought the building next door to us.
The only person who's ever been cured of Alzheimer's, Ernie Sanders. Are there any suspicions of that, or are people just...
Well, there's a lot of suspicion of that, you know, but I mean, I was reading the paper. I mean, his doctor gave a statement, you know, so basically, I mean, we kind of have to believe him, at least for now. And the interesting notice as well, José Dirceu, another one who was arrested, he's a former aide of President Lula. He basically urged President Lula to kind of defend the people who went to jail. I don't think that's a good strategy for some reason.
No, probably not.
Rule of law, generally quite a good thing to adhere to. Let's look at something else in the Folha de São Paulo. The Brazilian university, the further education system, which just seems to be terribly complicated but very prejudicial against lots of people. There's news there, isn't there?
Exactly. But basically yesterday was the day, the exams day for the best university of São Paulo, of Brazil, actually, which is the University of São Paulo. So all the students, they had to do this test, which is called FUVEST. And I have to say, it's extremely hard. I mean, it's a public university, so you don't have to pay for it. But in the end, the students who go through are usually the ones who manage to study in very good private schools and quite expensive as well. So I remember, because I did it when I was very young, you know, they have questions from chemistry to biology and philosophy. Even if you're applying for journalism, you have to know everything about physics, otherwise you would not get through.
Well, I mean, that's the same here. I mean, yeah, ask me any question about physics and, you know, I just, you know, it would roll off my tongue.
This is not a physics room.
and I remember I got, because there's 12 questions of each topic. When I did it, I got 11 out of 12 right in history and just 1 out of 12 for physics. And yeah, I didn't go through.
We
I have
would
to
do
say.
Terribly in a pub quiz, gentlemen, wouldn't we?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
We'd have great gaps. Let's move to public transport in Sao Paulo. This is in another paper, isn't it? This is in O Estado. What's happening now? There's a sort of a monthly pass that's been introduced.
Yeah, which I think is quite groundbreaking. You know, when I was living in Sao Paulo, I thought this would be so useful. And I think for most workers now, it's going to be a bit cheaper as well, because then now you're going to pay, like, I think most big cities like New York or London, now you're going to pay a fee and then you can use as much as you want, the buses, the trains, the underground as well. And I think this would be kind of a boost for the current mayor of São Paulo, again from the Workers' Party, Fernando Haddad, which is not doing very well at all in the polls, actually.
And is this move linked at all to those protests that we saw earlier this year as a way of saying, well, look, this is perhaps how we can deal with the cost of transport long term?
Absolutely, because as you know, the protest is all started because of the price of the bus fare. So I think there's now it's quite an important issue for most paulistanos.
Let's move on finally. I'm not sure why I'm introducing this, but I will do anyway. Eroticism hits Brazilian music.
Exactly. I mean, people say, oh, this is not surprising, but actually it is. There's a new apparently erotic wave in Brazilian music, but it's a very interesting feature in today's globe where a lot of artists are using sex in their songs and videos and poems, but not like in the past where it's just kind of, oh, hot girls, blah, 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 you know? Now they're really kind of exploring the aspects of nudity, and a lot of famous artists like Otto, which is a great musician from the northeast of Brazil, he did a video recently showing a lot of nudity. I could even say it's quite tasteful somehow. So it's interesting, and there's a lot of quotes saying that Brazilian music was quite conservative for a while.
Well, as the country is to a certain extent.
Exactly. So I welcome this new erotic wave in Brazilian music.
As we all do. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, as ever, thank you very much for joining us with your new erotic wave. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producer Daphne Denis, our researchers Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Bullock, and our studio manager Bill Lutie.
Up next after the news is The Urbanist with our editor Andrew Tuck. Stay tuned, of course, for the briefing. That's at 12 o'clock London time, 7 a.m. in New York. We'll be talking about Iran, lots and lots, I promise.
Dom Reynolds and Phil Hahn will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. That's at 8 a.m. London time. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.